The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi everybody, this is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. This week, I will continue with our series on the 13 short stories published by J.D. Salinger in the New Yorker in the 1950s. We are up to number 12, and it is entitled Seymour, An Introduction, published in the June 6, 1959 issue of the New Yorker magazine. The actors, by their presence, always convince me, to my horror, that most of what I've written about them until now is false. It is false because I write about them with steadfast love. Even now, while I write it down, this too becomes false. But varying ability, and this varying ability does not hit off the real actors loudly and correctly, but loses itself dully in this love that will never be satisfied with the ability, and therefore thinks it is protecting the actors by preventing this ability from exercising itself. It is, to describe it figuratively, as if an author were to make a slip of the pen, and as if this clerical error became conscious of being such. Perhaps this was no error, but in a far higher sense was an essential part of the whole exposition. It is, then, as if this clerical error were to revolt against the author out of hatred for him, were to forbid him to correct it, and were to say, "No, I will not be erased. I will stand as a witness against thee that thou art a very poor writer." At times, frankly, I find it pretty slim pickings, but at the age of 40, I look on my old fair-weather friend, the general reader, as my last deeply contemporary confidant, and I was rather strenuously requested, long before I was out of my teens, by at once the most exciting and the least fundamentally bumptious public craftsman I've ever personally known, to try to keep a steady and sober regard for the amenities of such a relationship, be it ever so peculiar or terrible. In my case, he saw it coming on from the first. The question is, how can a writer observe the amenities if he has no idea what his general reader is like? The reverse is common enough, most certainly. But just when is the author of a story ever asked what he thinks the reader is like? Very luckily, to push on and make my point here, and I don't think it's the kind of point that will survive an interminable build-up, I found out a good many years back practically all I need to know about my general reader. That is to say, you. You'll deny it up and down, I suspect, but I'm really in no position to take your word for it. You're a great bird lover. Much like a man in a short story called School Skeery by John Buchan, which Arnold L. Sugarman, Jr. once pressed me to read during a very poorly supervised study hall period. You're someone who took up birds in the first place because they fired your imagination. They fascinated you because, quote, they seemed of all created beings the nearest to pure spirit. Those little creatures with a normal temperature of 125 degrees, end quote. Probably, just like this John Buchan man, you thought many thrilling related thoughts. You reminded yourself, I don't doubt, that, quote, the goldcrest, with a stomach no bigger than a bean, flies across the North Sea. The curlew sandpiper, which breeds so far north that only about three people have ever seen its nest, goes to Tasmania for its holidays. End quote. It would be too much of a good thing to hope, of course, that my very own general reader should turn out to be one of the three people who have actually seen the curlew sandpiper's nest. But I feel, at least, that I know him, you, quite well enough to guess what kind of well-meant gesture might be welcomed from me right now. In this entre-nous spirit, then, old confidant, before we join the others, the grounded everywhere, including, I'm sure, the middle-aged hot rodders who insist on zooming us to the moon, the Dharma bums, the makers of cigarette filters for thinking men, the beat and the sloppy and the petulant, the chosen cultist, all the lofty experts who know so well what we should or shouldn't do with our poor little sex organs, all the bearded, proud, unlettered young men and unskilled guitarists and zen killers and incorporated aesthetic teddy boys who look down through their thoroughly unenlightened noses at this splendid planet where, please don't shut me up, Kilroy, Christ, and Shakespeare all stopped. Before we join these others, I privately say to you, old friend, unto you really, I'm afraid, please accept from me this unpretentious bouquet of very early blooming parentheses. Note, there are 8 parentheses following that. I suppose most unflorally, I truly mean them to be taken, first off, as bow-legged, buckle-legged omens of my state of mind and body at this writing. Professionally speaking, which is the only way I've ever really enjoyed speaking up, and just to ingratiate myself still less, I speak 9 languages, incessantly, 4 of them stone dead. Professionally speaking, I repeat, I'm an ecstatically happy man. I've never been before. Oh, once perhaps when I was 14 and wrote a story in which all the characters had Heidelberg dueling scars, the hero, the villain, the heroine, her old nanny, all the horses and dogs. I was reasonably happy then, you might say, but not ecstatically, not like this. To the point, I happen to know, possibly none better, that an ecstatically happy writing person is often a totally draining type to have around. Of course, the poets in this state are by far the most difficult, but even the prose writer, similarly seized, hasn't any real choice of behavior in decent company. Divine or not, a seizure's a seizure. And while I think an ecstatically happy prose writer can do many things on the printed page, the best things, I'm frankly hoping, it's also true and infinitely more self-evident, I fear, that he can't be moderate or temperate or brief. He loses very nearly all his short paragraphs. He can't be detached, or only very rarely and suspiciously, on downwaves. In the wake of anything as large and consuming as happiness, he necessarily forfeits the much smaller, but for a writer, always rather exquisite pleasure of appearing on the page serenely sitting on a fence. Worst of all, I think, he's no longer in a position to look after the reader's most immediate want, namely, to see the author get the hell on with his story. Hence, in part, that ominous offering of parentheses a few sentences back. I'm aware that a good many perfectly intelligent people can't stand parenthetical comments while a story is purportedly being told. Parentheses were advised of all these things by mail, mostly, granted, by thesis preparers with very natural, odie urges to write us under the table in their off-campus time. But we read, and usually we believe, good, bad, or indifferent, any string of English words holds our attention as if it came from Prospero himself. Close parentheses. I'm here to advise that not only will my asides run rampant from this point on, open parentheses, I'm not sure, in fact, that there won't be a footnote or two, close parentheses, but I fully intend, from time to time, to jump up personally on the reader's back when I see something off the beaten plot line that looks exciting or interesting and worth steering toward. Speed, here, God save my American hide, means nothing whatever to me. There are, however, readers who seriously require only the most restrained, most classical, and possibly deftest methods of having their attention drawn, and I suggest, as honestly as a writer can suggest this sort of thing, that they leave now, while I can imagine the leaving's good and easy. I'll probably continue to point out available exits as we move along, but I'm not sure I'll pretend to put my heart into it again. I'd like to start out with some rather unstinting words about those two opening quotations. "The actors by their presence" is from Kafka. The second one, "It is as if an author were to make a slip of the pen," is from Kierkegaard. Open parentheses, "and it's all I can do to keep from unattractively rubbing my hands together at the thought that this particular Kierkegaard passage may catch a few existentialist and somewhat overpublished French mandarins with their, well, by some little surprise," in parentheses. I don't really deeply feel that anyone needs an airtight reason for quoting from the works of writers he loves, but it's always nice, I'll grant you, if he has one. In this case, it seems to me that those two passages, especially in contiguity, are wonderfully representative of the best, in a sense, not only of Kafka and Kierkegaard, but of all the four dead men, the four variously notorious sick men or under-adjusted bachelors, open parentheses, probably only Van Gogh of the four will be excused from making a guest appearance in these pages, close parentheses, whom I most often run to, occasionally in real distress, when I want any perfectly credible information about modern artistic processes. By and large, I've reproduced the two passages to try to suggest very plainly how I think I stand in regard to the overall mass of data I hope to assemble here, a thing that in some quarters I don't a bit mind saying an author can't be too explicit about or any too early. In part, though, it would be rewarding for me to think, to dream, that those two short quotations may quite conceivably serve as a sort of spot convenience to the comparatively new breed of literary critics, the many workers, open parentheses, soldiers, I suppose you could say, close parentheses, who put in long hours, often with waning hopes of distinction, in our busy neo-Freudian arts and letters clinics, especially perhaps those still very young students and greener clinicians, themselves implicitly bursting with good mental health themselves, undeniably, I think, free of any inherent morbid attraction to beauty, who one day intend to specialize in aesthetic pathology. Open parentheses. Admittedly, this is a subject I've felt flinty about since I was 11 years old and watched the artist and sick man I've loved most in this world, then still in knee pads, being examined by a reputable group of professional Freudians for 6 hours and 45 minutes. In my not altogether reliable opinion, they stopped just short of taking a brain smear from him, and I've had an idea for years that only the latish hour, 2 a.m., dissuaded them from doing exactly that. Flinty, then, I do indeed mean to sound here. Churlish? No. I can perceive, though, that it's a very thin line or plank, but I'd like to try to walk it for a minute more. Ready or not, I've waited a good many years to collect these sentiments and get them off, in parentheses. A great variety of rumors, of course, run high and wide about the extraordinarily, the sensationally creative artist, and I'm alluding exclusively here to painters and poets and full dichters. One of these rumors, and by far to me the most exhilarating of the lot, is that he has never even in the pre-psychoanalytical dark ages deeply venerated his professional critics and has, in fact, usually lumped them in his generally unsound views of society with the art publishers and art dealers and the other, perhaps enviably prosperous camp followers of the arts who, he's just scarcely said to concede, would prefer different, possibly cleaner work if they could get it. But what, at least in modern times, I think one most recurrently hears about the curiously productive, though ailing poet or painter, is that he is invariably a kind of supersized but unmistakably classical neurotic, an aberrant who only occasionally and never deeply wishes to surrender his aberration. Or, in English, a sick man who not at all seldom, though he's reported to childlessly deny it, gives out terrible cries of pain as if he would wholeheartedly let go both his art and his soul to experience what passes in other people for wellness. And yet, open parentheses, the rumor continues, close parentheses, when his unsalutary-looking little room is broken into and someone, not infrequently at that, someone who actually loves him, passionately asks him where the pain is. He either declines or seems unable to discuss it at any constructive clinical length. And in the morning, when even great poets and painters presumably feel a bit more chipper than usual, he looks more perversely determined than ever to see his sickness run its course, as though by the light of another, presumably working day, he had remembered that all men, the healthy ones included, eventually die, and usually with a certain amount of bad grace, but that he, lucky man, is at least being done in by the most stimulating companion, disease or no, he has ever known. On the whole, treacherous as it may sound, coming from me, with just such a dead artist in the immediate family as I've been alluding to throughout this near polemic, I don't see how one can rationally deduce that this last general rumor, and mouthful, isn't based on a fairish amount of substantial fact. While my distinguished relative lived, I watched him, almost literally. I sometimes think like a hawk. By every logical definition, he was an unhealthy specimen. He did, on his worst nights and late afternoons, give out not only cries of pain, but cries for help. And when nominal help arrived, he did decline to say in perfectly intelligible language where it hurt. Even so, I do openly cavil with the declared experts in these matters, the scholars, the biographers, and especially the current ruling intellectual aristocracy educated in one or another of the big public psychoanalytical schools, and I cavil with them most acrimoniously over this. They don't listen properly to cries of pain when they come. They can't, of course. They're a peerage of 10 ears. With such faulty equipment, with those ears, how can anyone possibly trace the pain, by sound and quality alone, back to its source? With such wretched hearing equipment, the best, I think, that can be detected and perhaps verified is a few stray, thin overtones, hardly even counterpoint, coming from a troubled childhood or a disordered libido. But where does by far the bulk, the whole ambulance load of pain really come from? Where must it come from? Isn't the true poet or painter a seer? Isn't he actually the only seer we have on earth? Most apparently not the scientist, most emphatically not the psychiatrist. Surely the one and only great poet the psychoanalysts have had was Freud himself. He had a little ear trouble of his own, no doubt, but who in his right mind could deny that an epic poet was at work? Forgive me, I'm nearly finished with this. In a seer, what part of the human anatomy would necessarily be required to take the most abuse? The eyes, certainly. Please, dear general reader, as a last indulgence, if you're still here, reread those two short passages from Kafka and Kierkegaard I started out with. Isn't it clear? Don't those cries come straight from the eyes? However contradictory the coroner's report, whether he pronounces consumption or loneliness or suicide to be the cause of death, isn't it plain how the true artist seer actually dies? I say, open parentheses, and everything that follows in these pages all too possibly stands or falls on my being at least nearly right, close parentheses. I say that the true artist seer, the heavenly fool who can and does produce beauty, is mainly dazzled to death by his own scruples, the blinding shapes and colors of his own sacred human conscience. My credo is stated. I sit back. I sigh. Happily, I'm afraid. I light a Murad and go on, I hope to God, to other things. Something now, and briskly if I can, about that subtitle and introduction up near the top of the marquee. My central character here, at least in those lucid intervals when I can prevail upon myself to sit down and be reasonably quiet, will be my late and eldest brother, Seymour Glass, who, and I think I prefer to say this in one obituary-like sentence, in 1948, at the age of 31, while vacationing down in Florida with his wife, committed suicide. He was a great many things to a great many people while he lived, and virtually all things to his brothers and sisters in our somewhat outsized family. Surely he was all real things to us. Our blue-striped unicorn, our double-lensed burning glass, our consultant genius, our portable conscience, our supercargo, and our one full poet, and inevitably, I think, since not only was reticence never his strongest suit, but he spent nearly 7 years of his childhood as star turn on a children's coast-to-coast radio quiz program, so there wasn't much that didn't eventually get aired one way or another. Inevitably, I think, he was also our rather notorious mystic and unbalanced type. And since I'm obviously going whole hog right here at the outset, I'll further enunciate, if one can enunciate and shout at the same time, that, with or without a suicide plot in his head, he was the only person I've ever habitually consorted with, banged around with, who more frequently than not tallied with the classical conception, as I saw it, of a mukta, a ring-ding enlightened man, a God-knower. At any rate, his character lends itself to no legitimate sort of narrative compactness that I know of, and I can't conceive of anyone, least of all myself, trying to write him off in one shot or in one fairly simple series of sittings, whether arranged by the month or the year. I come to the point. My original plans for this general space were to write a short story about Seymour and to call it Seymour One, with the big O-N-E serving as a built-in convenience to me, Buddy Glass, even more than to the reader. A helpful, flashy reminder that other stories, a Seymour Two, Three, and possibly Four, would logically have to follow. Those plans no longer exist. Or, if they do, and I suspect that this is much more likely how things stand, they've gone underground. With an understanding, perhaps, that I'll rap three times when I'm ready. But on this occasion, I'm anything but a short story writer where my brother is concerned. What I am, I think, is a thesaurus of undetached prefatory remarks about him. I believe I essentially remain what I've almost always been, a narrator, but one with extremely pressing personal needs. I want to introduce, I want to describe, I want to distribute mementos, amulets, I want to break out my wallet and pass around snapshots, I want to follow my nose. In this mood, I don't dare go anywhere near the short story form. It eats up fat little undetached writers like me whole. But I have many, many unfelicitous-sounding things to tell you. For instance, I'm saying, cataloging, so much so early about my brother. I feel you must have noticed. You may also have noticed, and I know it hasn't entirely escaped my attention, that everything I've said so far about Seymour and about his blood type in general, as it were, has been graphically panegyric. It gives me pause, all right. Granted that I haven't come to bury but to exhume and most likely to praise, I nonetheless suspect that the honor of cool, dispassionate narrators everywhere is remotely at stake here. Had Seymour no grievous faults, no vices, no meannesses that can be listed, at least in a hurry? What was he, anyway? A saint? Thankfully, it isn't my responsibility to answer that one. Oh, lucky day. Let me change the subject and say, without hesitation, he had a Heinz-like variety of personal characteristics that threatened, at different chronological intervals of sensitivity or thin-skinnedness, to drive every miner in the family to the bottle. In the first place, there is very evidently one rather terrible hallmark common to all persons who look for God, and apparently with enormous success, in the queerest imaginable places, e.g., in radio announcers and newspapers and taxicabs with crooked meters literally everywhere. Open parentheses. My brother, for the record, had a distracting habitat most of his adult life of investigating loaded ashtrays with his index finger, clearing all the cigarette ends to the sides, and smiling from ear to ear as he did it, as if he expected to see Christ himself curled up cherubically in the middle, and he never looked disappointed. In parentheses. The hallmark, then, of the advanced religious non-sectarian or any other, and I graciously include in the definition of an advanced religious, odious though the phrase is, all Christians on the great Vivekananda's terms, i.e., quote, see Christ, then you are a Christian, all else is talk, end quote. Close parentheses. The hallmark most commonly identifying this person is that he very frequently behaves like a fool, even an imbecile. It's a trial to a family that has a real grandee in it if he can't always be relied on to behave like one. I'm now about to quit cataloging, but I can't do so quite at this point without citing what I think was his most trying personal characteristic. It had to do with his speech habits, or rather, the anomalous range of his speech habits. Vocally, he was either as brief as a gatekeeper at a Trappist monastery, sometimes for days, weeks at a stretch, or he was a non-stop talker. When he was wound up, and to state the matter exactly, almost everybody was forever winding him up, and then, of course, quickly sitting in close, the better to pick his brains. When he was wound up, it was nothing for him to talk for hours at a time, occasionally with no redeeming awareness whatever that one or two or 10 other people were in the room. He was an inspired, non-stop talker, I'm firmly suggesting, but to put it very mildly, even the most sublimely accomplished non-stop talker can't consistently please. And I say that, I should add, less from any repellent, splendid impulse to play fair with my invisible reader than, much worse, I suppose, because I believe that this particular non-stop talker can take almost any amount of knocking. Certainly for me, at any rate. I'm in the unique position of being able to call my brother straight out a non-stop talker, which is a pretty vile thing to call somebody, I think. And yet at the same time, to sit back rather, I'm afraid, like a type with both sleeves full of aces, and effortlessly remember a whole legion of mitigating factors. And mitigating is hardly the word for it. I can condense them all into one. By the time Seymour was in mid-adolescence, 16, 17, he not only had learned to control his native vernacular, his many, many less than elite New York speech mannerisms, but had by them already come into his own true bullseye poet's vocabulary. His nonstop talks, his monologues, his near harangues then came as close to pleasing from start to finish, for a good many of us anyway, as, say, the bulk of Beethoven's output after he ceased being encumbered with a sense of hearing. And maybe I'm thinking especially, though, it seems a trifle picky of the B-flat major and C-sharp minor quartets. Still, we were a family of seven children originally. And as it happened, none of us was in the least tongue-tied. It's an exceedingly weighty matter when six naturally profuse verbalizers and expounders have an undefeatable champion talker in the house. True, he never sought the title, and he passionately yearned to see one or another of us outpoint or simply outlast him in a conversation or an argument. A small matter which, of course, though he himself never saw it, he had his blank spots like everybody else, bothered some of us all the more. The fact remains that the title was always his, and though I think he would have given almost anything on earth to retire it, this is the weightiest matter of all, surely, and I'm not going to be able to explore it deeply for another few years. He never did find a completely graceful way of doing it. At this point, it doesn't seem to me merely chummy to mention that I've written about my brother before. For that matter, with a little good-humored cajoling, I might conceivably admit that there's seldom been a time when I haven't written about him. And if, presumably at gunpoint, I had to sit down tomorrow and write a story about a dinosaur, I don't doubt that I'd inadvertently give the big chap one or two small mannerisms reminiscent of Seymour, a singularly endearing way of biting off the top of a hemlock, say, or of wagging his 30-foot tail. Some people, not close friends, have asked me whether a lot of Seymour didn't go into the young leading character of the one novel I've published. Actually, most of these people haven't asked me. They've told me. To protest this at all, I found, makes me break out in hives. But I will say that no one who knew my brother has asked me or told me anything of the kind, for which I'm grateful and, in a way, more than a bit impressed, since a good many of my main characters speak Manhattanese fluently and idiomatically, have a rather common flair for rushing in where most damn fools fear to tread, and are, by and large, pursued by an entity that I'd much prefer to identify very roughly as the old man of the mountain. But what I can and should state is that I've written and published two short stories that were supposedly to be directly about Seymour. The more recent of the two, published in 1955, was a highly inclusive recount of his wedding day in 1942. The details were served up with a fullness, possibly just short of presenting the reader with a sherbet mold of each and every wedding guest's footprint to take home as a souvenir, but Seymour himself, the main course, didn't actually put in a physical appearance anywhere. On the other hand, in the earlier, much shorter story I did, back in the late 40s, he not only appeared in the flesh, but walked, talked, went for a dip in the ocean, and fired a bullet through his brain in the last paragraph. However, several members of my immediate, if somewhat far-flung family who regularly pick over my published prose for small technical errors, have gently pointed out to me, much too damned gently since they usually come down on me like grammarians, that the young man, the Seymour, who did the walking and talking in that early story, not to mention the shooting, was not Seymour at all, but oddly someone with a striking resemblance to, alley-oop, I'm afraid, myself. Which is true, I think, or true enough to make me feel a craftsman's ping of reproof. And while there's no good excuse for that kind of faux pas, I can't forbear to mention that the particular story was written just a couple of months after Seymour's death, and not too very long after I myself, like both the Seymour in the story and the Seymour in real life, had returned from the European Theater of Operations. I was using a very poorly rehabilitated, not to say unbalanced, German typewriter at the time. Oh, this happiness is strong stuff. It's marvelously liberating. I'm free. I feel, to tell you exactly what you must be longing to hear now. That is, if, as I know you do, you love best in this world those little beings of pure spirit with a normal temperature of 125 degrees, then it naturally follows that the creature you love next best is the person, the God-lover or God-hater, almost never apparently anything in between, the saint or profligate, moralist or complete immoralist, who can write a poem that is a poem. Among human beings, he's the curlew sandpiper, and I hasten to tell you what little I presume to know about his flights, his heat, his incredible heart. Since early in 1948, I've been sitting, my family thinks literally, on a loose-leaf notebook inhabited by 184 short poems that my brother wrote during the last 3 years of his life, both in and out of the Army, but mostly in, well in. I intend very soon now, it's just a matter of days or weeks, I tell myself, to stand aside from about 150 of the poems and let the first willing publisher who owns a pressed morning suit and a fairly clean pair of gray gloves bear them away right off to his shady presses, where they'll very likely be constrained in a two-tone dust jacket complete with a back flap featuring a few curiously damning remarks of endorsement, as solicited and acquired from those name poets and writers who have no compunction about commenting in public on their fellow artists' works, open parentheses, customarily reserving their more deeply quarter-hearted commendations for their friends, suspected inferiors, foreigners, fly-by-night oddities, and toilers in another field, in parentheses. Then on to the Sunday literary sections where, if there's room, if the critique of the big, new, definitive biography of Grover Cleveland doesn't run too long, they'll be tersely introduced to the poetry-loving public by one of the little band of regulars, moderate-salaried pedants, and income supplementers who can be trusted to review new books of poetry, not necessarily either wisely or passionately, but tersely. Open parentheses, I don't think I'll strike quite this sour note again, but if I do, I'll try to be equally transparent about it. Close parentheses. Now, considering that I've been sitting on the poems for over 10 years, it might be, well, refreshingly normal, or unperverse at least, if I gave what I think are the two main reasons I've elected to get up, rise from them. And I prefer to pack both reasons into the same paragraph, duffel bag style, partly because I'd like them to stick close to each other, partly because I have a perhaps impetuous notion that I won't be needing them again on the voyage. First, there is the matter of family pressure. It's doubtless a very common thing, if not much more common than I'd care to hear about, but I have 4 living, littered, rather incontinently articulate younger brothers and sisters of part Jewish, part Irish, and conceivably part Minotaur extraction. 2 boys, 1, Waker, an ex-roving Carthusian monk reporter, now impounded, and the other, Zoe, a no less vigorously called and chosen non-sectarian actor, aged respectively 36 and 29, and 2 girls, one a budding young actress, Franny, and the other, Boo Boo, a bouncy, solvent Westchester matron, aged respectively 25 and 38. Off and on since 1949, from seminary and boarding school, from the obstetrical floor of women's hospital and the exchange student's writing room, below the waterline on the Queen Elizabeth, between, as it were, exams and dress rehearsals, and 2 o'clock feedings, all 4 of these dignitaries have been laying down, through the mail, a series of unspecified but discernibly black ultimatums of what will happen to me unless I do something soon about Seymour's poems. It should be noted, perhaps immediately, that besides being a writing man, I'm a part-time English department member at a girls' college in Upper New York, not far from the Canadian border. I live alone, but Catless, I'd like everybody to know, in a totally modest, not to say cringing, little house set deep in the woods and on the more inaccessible side of a mountain. Not counting students, faculty, and middle-aged waitresses, I see very few people during the working week or year. I belong, in short, to a species of literary shut-in that, I don't doubt, can be coerced or bullied pretty successfully by mail. Everybody, anyhow, has a saturation point, and I can no longer open my post office box without excessive trepidation at the prospect of finding, nestled among the farm equipment circulars and the bank statements, a long, chatty, threatening postcard from one of my brothers or sisters, two of whom, it seems peculiarly worth adding, use ballpoint pens. My second main reason for deciding to let go of the poems, get them published, is, in a way, much less emotional, really, than physical. Open parentheses. And it leads, I'm proud as a peacock to say, straight to the swamps of rhetoric. Close parentheses. The effects of radioactive particles on the human body, so topical in 1959, are nothing new to old poetry lovers. Used with moderation, a first-class verse is an excellent and usually fast-working form of heat therapy. Once in the Army, when I had what might be termed ambulatory pleurisy for something over 3 months, my first real relief came only when I had placed a perfectly innocent-looking Blake lyric in my shirt pocket and worn it like a poultice for a day or so. Extremes, though, are always risky and ordinarily downright baneful. And the dangers of prolonged contact with any poetry that seems to exceed what we most familiarly know of the first class are formidable. In any case, I'd be relieved to see my brother's poems moved out of this general small area, at least for a while. I feel mildly but extensively burned. And on what seems to me the soundest basis, during much of his adolescence and all his adult life, Seymour was drawn first to Chinese poetry and then as deeply to Japanese poetry and to both in ways that he was drawn to no other poetry in the world. Footnote, since this is a record of sorts, I ought to mumble down here that he read Chinese and Japanese poetry for the most part as it was written. Another time around, probably at irksome length, to me, I'm going to have to dwell on an odd inborn characteristic common to some extent to all the original seven children in our family, and as pronounced as a limp in three of us, which made it possible for us to learn foreign languages with extreme ease. But this footnote is mainly for young readers. If in the line of duty, I should incidentally titillate a few young people's interest in Chinese and Japanese poetry, it would be very good news to me. At all events, let the young person please know, if he doesn't already, that a goodish amount of first-class Chinese poetry has been translated into English with much fidelity and spirit by several distinguished people. Witter Bynner and Lionel Giles come most readily to mind. The best short Japanese poems, including haiku, but senryu too, can be read with special satisfaction when R.H. Blythe has been at them. Blythe is sometimes perilous, naturally, since he's a high-handed old poem himself, but he's also sublime. And who goes to poetry for safety anyway? Open parentheses. This last little piece of pedantry, I repeat, is for the young, who write to authors and never get any replies from the beast. I'm also functioning, partly, on behalf of my title character, who was a teacher, too. Poor bastard. I have no quick way of knowing, of course, how familiar or unfamiliar my dear, if victimized, general reader is with Chinese or Japanese poetry. Considering, however, that even a short discussion of it may possibly shed a good deal of light on my brother's nature, I don't think this is the time for me to go all reticent and forbearing. At their most effective, I believe, Chinese and Japanese classical verses are intelligible utterances that please or enlighten or enlarge the invited eavesdropper to within an inch of his life. They may be, and often are, fine for the ear particularly, but for the most part I'd say that unless a Chinese or Japanese poet's real forte is knowing a good persimmon or a good crab or a good mosquito bite on a good arm when he sees one, then no matter how long or unusual or fascinating his semantic or intellectual intestines may be, or how beguiling they sound when twanged, no one in the mysterious East speaks seriously of him as a poet, if at all. My inner incessant elation, which I think I've rightly, if repeatedly, called happiness, is threatening, I'm aware, to turn this whole composition into a fool's soliloquy. I think, though, that even I haven't the gall to try to say what makes the Chinese or Japanese poet the marvel and the joy he is. Something, however, wouldn't you know, does happen to come to mind. I don't imagine it's precisely the thing I'm looking for, but I can't simply throw it out. Once, a terrible number of years ago, when Seymour and I were 8 and 6, our parents gave a party for nearly 60 people in our 3.5 rooms at the old Hotel Almack in New York. They were officially retiring from vaudeville, and it was an affecting as well as a celebrative occasion. We, too, were allowed to get out of bed around 11 or so and come in and have a look. We had more than a look. By request and with no objections whatever on our part, we danced, we sang, first singly and then together, as children of our station often do. But mostly we just stayed up and watched. Toward 2 in the morning, when the leave takings began, Seymour begged Bessie, our mother, to let him bring the leavers their coats, which were hung, draped, tossed, piled all over the small apartment, even on the foot of our sleeping younger sister's bed. He and I knew about a dozen of the guests intimately, 10 or so more by sight or reputation, and the rest not at all or hardly. We had been in bed, I should add, when everyone arrived. But from watching the guests for some 3 hours, from grinning at them, from, I think, loving them, Seymour, without asking any questions first, brought very nearly all the guests, one or two at a time, and without any mistakes, their own true coats, and all the men involved their hats. The women's hats he had some trouble with. Now, I don't necessarily suggest that this is a kind of feat is typical of the Chinese or Japanese poet, and certainly I don't mean to imply that it makes him what he is, but I do think that if a Chinese or Japanese verse composer doesn't know whose coat is whose on sight, his poetry stands a remarkably slim chance of ever ripening. And 8, I'd guess, is very nearly the outside age limit for mastering this small feat. Open parentheses. No, I can't stop now. It seems to me, in my condition, that I'm no longer merely asserting my brother's position as a poet. I feel I'm removing, at least for a minute or two, all the detonators from all the bombs in this bloody world. A very tiny, purely temporary public courtesy, no doubt, but mine own. In parentheses. It's generally agreed that Chinese and Japanese poets like simple subjects best, and I'd feel more oafish than usual if I tried to refute that, but simple happens to be a word I personally hate like poison, since, where I come from anyway, it's customarily applied to the unconscionably brief, the time-saving in general, the trivial, the bald, and the abridged. My personal phobias aside, I don't really believe there is a word in any language, thank God, to describe the Chinese or Japanese poet's choice of material. I wonder who can find a word for this kind of thing. A proud, pompous cabinet member walking in his courtyard and reliving a particularly devastating speech he made that morning in the emperor's presence, steps, with regret, on a pen and ink sketch someone has lost or discarded. Parentheses. Woe is me, there's a prose writer in our midst. I have to use italics where the oriental poet wouldn't. Close parentheses. The great Issa will joyfully advise us that there's a fat-faced peony in the garden. open parentheses, no more, no less. Whether we go to see his fat-faced peony for ourselves is another matter. Unlike certain prose writers and Western poetasters, whom I'm in no position to name off, he doesn't police us. Close parentheses. The very mention of Issa's name convinces me that the true poet has no choice of material. The material plainly chooses him, not he it. A fat-faced peony will not show itself to anyone but Issa. Not to Busan, not to Shiki, not even to Basu. The same rule holds for the proud and pompous cabinet member. He will not dare to step with divinely human regret on a piece of sketch paper till the great commoner, bastard, and poet Lao Ti Kao has arrived on the scene to watch. The miracle of Chinese and Japanese verse is that one pure poet's voice is absolutely the same as another's and at once absolutely distinctive and different. Tang Li divulges, when he is 93 and is praised to his face for his wisdom and charity, that his piles are killing him. For another, at last, example, Ko Huang observes, with tears coursing down his face, that his late master had extremely bad table manners. Open parentheses, there is a risk, always, of being a trifle too beastly to the West. A line exists in Kafka's diaries, one of many of his really, that could easily usher in the Chinese New Year. Quote, the young girl who only because she was walking arm in arm with her sweetheart looked quietly around. End quote. Close parentheses. As for my brother Seymour, my brother Seymour. For this Semitic, Celtic, Oriental, I need a spanking new paragraph. Unofficially, Seymour wrote and talked Chinese and Japanese poetry all the 31 years he stopped with us. But I'd say that he made a formal beginning at composing it one morning when he was 11, in the first floor reading room of a public library on Upper Broadway near our house. It was a Saturday, no school, nothing more pressing ahead of us than lunch, and we were having a fine time idly swimming around or treading water between the stacks, occasionally doing a little serious fishing for new authors, when he suddenly signaled to me to come over and see what he had. He'd caught himself a whole mess of translated verses by Pang, the wonder of the 11th century. But fishing, as we know, in libraries or anywhere else is a tricky business, with never a certainty of who's going to catch whom. Open parentheses. The hazards of fishing in general were themselves a favorite subject of Seymour's. Our younger brother, Walt, was a great bent pen fisherman as a small boy, and for his 9th or 10th birthday he received a poem from Seymour, one of the major delights of his life, I believe, about a little rich boy who catches a Lafayette in the Hudson River, experiences a fierce pain in his own lower lip on reeling him in, then dismisses the matter from his mind, only to discover, when he is home and the still-alive fish has been given the run of the bathtub, that he, the fish, is wearing a blue serge cap with the same school insignia over the peak as the boy's own. The boy finds his own name tape sewn inside the tiny wet cap. Close parentheses. Permanently, from that morning on, Seymour was hooked. By the time he was 14, one or two of us in the family were fairly regularly going through his jackets and windbreakers for anything good he might have jotted down during a slow gym period or a long wait at the dentist's. Open parentheses. A day has passed since this last sentence, and in the interim I've put through a long-distance call from my place of business to my sister, Boo Boo, in Tuckahoe, to ask her if there's any poem from Seymour's very early boyhood that she'd especially like to go into this account. She said she'd call me back. Her choice turned out to be not nearly so apposite to my present purposes as I'd like, and therefore a trifle irritating, but I think I'll get over it. The one she picked, I happen to know, was written when the poet was 8. Quote, John Keats, John Keats, John, please put your scarf on, end quote. Close parentheses. When he was 22, he had one special, not thin, sheaf of poems that looked very, very good to me, and I, who have never written a line longhand in my life without instantly visualizing it in 11-point type, rather fractiously urged him to submit them for publication somewhere. No, he didn't think he could do that. Not yet. Maybe never. They were too un-Western, too Lotus-y. He said he felt that they were faintly affronting. He hadn't quite made up his mind where the affronting came in, but he felt at times that the poems read as though they'd been written by an ingrate of sorts, someone who was turning his back, in effect, on his own environment and the people in it who were close to him. He said he ate his food out of our big refrigerators, drove our 8-cylinder American cars, unhesitatingly used our medicines when he was sick, and relied on the U.S. Army to protect his parents and sisters from Hitler's Germany, and nothing, not one single thing in all his poems reflected these realities. Something was terribly wrong. He said that so often after he'd finished a poem, he thought of Miss Overman. It should be said that Miss Overman had been the librarian in the first public library branch in New York we regularly used when we were children. He said he felt he owed Miss Overman a painstaking, sustained search for a form of poetry that was in accord with his own peculiar standards, and yet not wholly incompatible, even at first sight, with Miss Overman's taste. When he had opened a book to a plate of Leonardo's Catapult and placed it brightly before him, and that it was no joy to him to finish writing a poem and know that Miss Overman would have trouble turning to it with pleasure or involvement, coming, as she probably would come, fresh from her beloved Mr. Browning, or her equally dear and no less explicit Mr. Wordsworth. The argument, my argument, his discussion ended there. You can't argue with someone who believes or just passionately suspects that the poet's function is not to write what he must write, but rather to write what he would write if his life depended on his taking responsibility for writing what he must in a style designed to shut out as few of his old librarians as humanly possible. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next week for part two of the short story by J.D. Salinger, Seymour, An Introduction. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.